Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall. I promised that I would have Wayne Jett back to talk about the H.G. Wells Anticipations, it's called. It had a long title, but it's essentially the Elite Manifesto. The crazy thing about this book is the elites loved it, and they welcomed him with open arms, and he was a fixture amongst, you know, upper society. And the crazy part is he had an aggressive eugenics agenda in the book, and he thought the middle class was this great unwash that needs to be taken down. They thought the middle class was a dictatorship on the superior upper class that had the right to rule, and he thought that all the rest of the people were, the poor people were filth, and they just needed to be killed in all means necessary. That was actually written in this book, and he wasn't shunned by society. He was actually welcomed with open arms, and he's still respected highly today. H.G. Wells is considered a great author and somebody that is well respected. I don't know how somebody who could write something like that could be well respected. So it's really interesting to go back and talk to Wayne Jett about the Elite Manifesto and to hear all the details of it. Just like the details of the Great Depression, what you did not learn in school, I'm sure you're going to learn a lot of new things that you have not learned before. So let's welcome Wayne Jett back to the program. Hello, Wayne. Welcome back to the program.
Thank you very much, Sarah. I'm delighted to talk with you again.
I'm really glad that you decided to come back, because I think the H.G. Wells Anticipations, or the Elite Manifesto, as he calls it, is something that is really... it's interesting, so I think people want to hear it. But I don't think most people know what it was about and how it ties into history. And the fact that it ties into history is kind of weird to me. And so it's one of those things, that cognitive dissonance thing, like, wow, once you hear it. And you have done more research on this than almost anybody. So I really wanted to bring you back to talk about it and then tie into the episodes that you did with the Great Depression and those events and how it's starting to unfold the way he discussed it.
Well, that's great. I look forward to the discussion. Why don't we start with I'll set the stage for when the book came into being. And I like to do that by referring to the 20 years before 1901 when it was published.
But let's do a recap first, that what the book is, like, overall. Foretells a future where a scientific, ruthless elite gain effective control of society, but does it by proclaiming altruistic motives to the general public, and then proceeds to direct all affairs of mankind. I mean, I saw that as the overall gist of it. I don't know if that's what you see as the gist, but I kind of want to set... to give people an idea what the whole book was about, and then you can start talking about it.
Okay, well, let me say, I don't believe, as I read the book, that it is a pretense to be foretelling the future. What it was presented as was clearly nonfiction, and he appeared to be expressing his view. While he was expressing his view, he was at the same time indicating that this view is clearly one that was being held by others completely unnamed. So he was saying, this is what we've had, this is my view of history in the past, what society has always been organized to be, and what it is now, and what has got to be done if we want to restore it to where it was and where it ought to be. Where it was is where it ought to be, and what it is now is not. He makes that very clear, that those are his views. Now, when I tell you what his views are, I want to have a little bit of background about who he as a person was.
Oh, excellent. Go ahead and start that with... Yes.
Are not at all consistent. But in order to do that, I want to tell you that the 20 years before he published his book were 20 years in which two American presidents were assassinated. One in 1881, 1901. And those have a good deal of significance as to the views stated by him and whose views they are. Both the presidents that were assassinated were from Ohio. Both in large part were men of the people, although they certainly had different backgrounds. The first was James Garfield, very highly thought of, a scholarly man, and regarded as, before he ran for president, as by far the best speaker in the Congress. He was nominated by a runaway Republican convention in 1880. He was not supposed to get the nomination. It was supposed to be given to Grant, who was the establishment, to come in, bringing him back for a third term, although he'd been out of office and didn't run 4 years previously. And they lost to the Democrats. Republicans came back with him at the nominating convention, and it didn't fly. He certainly had the support of the top people, but he came in with a real view of doing what was right for the American people, highly popular with people at large, but very unpopular with the New York financial elite. The senior senator from New York threatened him before his inauguration that he would never be successful, and I would say almost certainly it threatened him with more than that if he did not do what he demanded. And that was essentially, he was to be permitted, the senior senator from New York, to name the Secretary of the Treasury, and that he was also supposed to be, he demanded the power to name the collector of tariffs at the Port of New York. Both very powerful positions at that time, because the tariffs of New York were the main source of federal funding at that time. There was no income tax. And it was a place of great corruption and so forth. Garfield told him no. Garfield told him not only no, but with those threats coming right up to the time of his inauguration, he rewrote his inauguration address within the 3 days or so before his inauguration. And he said explicitly in it that he was intending to refinance the debt of the United States. That means disrupting the financial affairs of the elite who held the debt, who owned the debt. Those were the financial banking people. And he was also going to redo the currency and so forth. So we're right in the bailiwick of what concerns the ruling elite. And he was certainly under attack at the time of his inauguration. He went ahead with that speech. And he was shot. He was sworn in March 15th. He was shot in May. The wounds were not fatal. He was shot twice in the back by a so-called lone assassin who just happened to have had contacts with the senior senator from New York and the man who was also nominated as vice president on the ticket, the one who would be establishment to take over in the event of his death. And those two wounds, however, were not at all fatal. He was shot in the railroad station when he was about to take a trip to his summer home to see his very ill wife. No protection whatsoever. And after being left for some time, he was treated by supposedly a staff of prominent, very prominent, powerful doctors. The one in charge, who demanded being in charge some way or other, insisted that they would not use any sterile protections in the treating of his wound, even though the French had just in the 1880 convention the year before had brought over their understanding of medicine and germ discussions and so forth. And it was clearly a matter within the understanding of the medical profession at that time. But they insisted there was a lost bullet in his body, in his lower abdomen. And they insisted upon having many doctors come in and examine the wound with their open fingers, time after time after time, probing for the bullet. And over a period of the next 2 to 3 months, he literally died from massive infection. That was the kind of treatment that was given to the president then. I could spend more time about it, but nevertheless, that was one of the Ohio presidents. In other words, a non-New Yorker, non-Easterner. And the other, supposedly he would have been a Rockefeller man. He was not. He was really a man of the people, Garfield. That was exactly the time, of course, at which Henry George's great book, Progress and Poverty, was hitting the public. And it became, as I've said before, the greatest selling book on economic matters ever written. 2 million copies sold within the 20 to 25 years after its publication in 1880, when he couldn't even find a publisher before that. Now, that it was at a time when there was no internet, there was no television, there were newspapers, but to be able to publicize and get out to the world and sell in that prodigious number is absolutely amazing. For a book of that nature, it was translated into many languages. It was bought around the world. I've told you before that he became the second or third most highly respected American, Henry George. And all of that period of time, well, in 86, as I've said, he was had already moved to New York because of the publication book there, and ran for mayor of New York, was narrowly defeated in what was almost undoubtedly election fraud by Tammany Hall. So he was right in the center of financial and intellectual affairs, Henry George was, during these 20 years. He ran against Teddy Roosevelt and badly defeated him in that election. And Teddy Roosevelt said if he did anything in the election right, even though he ran in a very weak third position, that he helped to defeat the ideas of Henry George. The ideas of how to diminish and destroy poverty, especially as it existed in such severe form right next to the locations of the greatest wealth in the country and in the world. And so in that circumstance, all of that intellectual discussion is going on in this period of time. Henry George then is talked into running again for mayor of New York in 1998 and dies mysteriously just before the election. Tammany Hall was sure it wasn't going to be able to defeat him, and within 2 weeks before the election, he's dead. So then we come to the year 1901 for the re-election, for the campaign for re-election of William McKinley, a popular man, also from Ohio, and somewhat the same. He was a lawyer, while Garfield had been an academic and then a congressional representative. But in any event, during his first term was the Spanish-American War. And it was a war that involved the destruction of the Maine, a U.S. ship in the harbor in Manila. And it was blamed upon the Spanish government. And then so we launched war against them, and we wound up with possessions in Guam and basically around the world, and domination over Cuba and so forth. So it was definitely something on the imperial agenda. However, he made peace in the war, the end of the war, and he ran in 1900 for re-election on a basis of anti-imperialism. And he was shot in September after being sworn in March. That's the timing for the publication in 1901 of anticipations of the reactions of society to mechanization and technology, something like that. Very long, forgettable title, as it's called Anticipations, written by an Englishman, H.G. Wells. H.G. Wells was not a member of the elite by any stretch of the imagination. He was born in England in a poor family. I think his father died with his mother. They were hand to mouth most of his childhood and so forth. But as he somehow got educated and began a career of writing science fiction and horror books and things of that sort. He had done practically a dozen of them during the 1890s and become somewhat prominent. But what really brought him to public attention was this book, Anticipations, published in 1901. It was his very first book of nonfiction. If you read the first two sections of his book, you would almost undoubtedly put it down and never pick it up again. The first two sections are not really what the book is about at all. They are about how cities have come about, and cities and towns, and how they're located with respect to each other, and basically, how the populace distributes itself. Very boring type things in large part. Transportation, matters of that kind. And then you get to the third section, and it tells you what it is about. He says that the world has come to a very different place than it's been for the past 5, 6, 7, 8 centuries. He says during all of that time, humanity was organized into a very stable system, one that was comprised of two classes, one being the entirely superior class, and the other being the humanity that is born to serve as slaves, as serfs, as peasants, what he called the human machinery required to do the sweat, toil, and work needed for the superior class to fulfill the role that they have, which is to rule the rest of the world and to live off the riches that they are able to exploit. And so he says, what we have come to now, however, is something that is threateningly different. It is a world in which there is another great gray mass of humanity which has boiled up. And it's called a middle class. The people who used to sweat and toil and work as serfs and slaves have become educated. They've started working, and they've presented themselves as having something to say about politics and the way the government is to be run and the way they are to be run. And they're asserting rights to actually determine that. And in fact, we've gone even further. They they argued that this thing, great gray mass, he called it, called democracy, is actually what is supposed to set the laws. And that is not the way it has ever been, and it's not the way it ought to be now. They are attempting to impose a dictatorship on those of the superior class who are clearly entitled by history and by all human practices in the past to rule.
Oh, geez. And
he says, unless we do something right now, it threatens to get out of hand so it can never be reversed. And in that circumstance, in order to go back to where we were, to that stable arrangement of society, we are going to have to destroy completely the fabric of society now and start anew. So that is basically the premises from which he set into the rest of the book to tell how that ought to be done. So it was not foretelling the future. He was saying this is what must be done in the future.
So it's essentially a roadmap for the elites, is what you're saying.
It was, and especially from the standpoint of his own upbringing, he would have had no exposure to these views at all in his own upbringing or from his parents. My interpretation of where he got this is that in his intellectual pursuits, he had become acquainted with those, and they chose him as a scribe or a shill. And he relished the role. He espoused these as his own ideas, and he rubbed shoulders with those people. But essentially, my conclusion is that what he was told and what he wrote in that book was the manifesto or game plan that the ruling elite had decided needed to be prepared and circulated among their own supporters so everybody would know the playbook and what was to come and what to be ready for and what to plan for and what to provide their support. And if they did not agree with it, what was to be their fate at the hands of the ruling elite? A clear statement of their fate was provided by Wells's descriptions of what he called the incompetent rich. Those who, either by inheritance or by their own productivity, had become wealthy and were willing to be benevolent and live with and even support and cherish members of that other class, that burgeoning gray matter called democracy, those people were to be destroyed. They would have no further role to play, period, and they would be wiped out. In fact, he had various means of doing that, and two of them that he describes explicitly in his book, there should be a graduated income tax on earnings that tax very heavily those with the highest earnings, those of the competent rich, in order to take their earnings, but also a death tax that would prevent their earnings during their lifetime, anything left after the income tax would be taken at their death, so it would not be passed along to their offspring to let their higher status in society proceed any longer.
So what did they do to make sure they stayed wealthy while they made the incompetent wealthy lose all their money?
He had a specific provision for that. they would have already protected, and they were doing so at the time that he wrote, they would be protected in what he called the trusts that are tax exempt, the foundations, the so-called charitables, or whatever you want to call it in terms of the excuse for giving them this status. But they're
the pretend charities that are supposed to be helping people.
The Carnegie Foundation was Endowment for International Peace is its actual name, had already been formed by then. The Rockefeller Foundation was formed just a few years thereafter. At the time, John D. Rockefeller was the most feared and hated man in the country in terms of his the power of his organization. It was called the Standard Trust. He had already called it a trust at that time, in which the funds are in an organization and they're used for his purposes, very secretive and so forth. John D. Rockefeller had been, or was described at that time as a giant black spider in a web, waiting for his next victim to come. And yet, at the same time, in the papers of society and so forth, those same people were revered and held in the highest esteem. But the whole charitable thing of their purposes was developed about that time in line with this tax-exempt status, in which their funds are put beyond the income tax. They are not, in effect, taxed at all. And they simply are outside the reach of the government's reach at the middle class and at those who earn their income by productivity. One of the things that Wells clearly says, the mark of the superior class is that they are bound by, he calls an ethic or a morality, bound not to toil for their living.
Well, you know what? I'm going to redefine what they are. They're the inferior class that is holding back the evolution of mankind. The middle class is an evolution of mankind. They are a leftover of an inferior, unevolved mankind who happen to have a lot of money, and it's getting in the way of us evolving. And that's the truth. But keep going.
Well, I would have to say, Sarah, that while I entirely agree with you in that aspiration that you just described, that the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st century is much in the favor of the views of Mr. Wells.
Well, I see that, and that's why I say so much that they're getting in the way of evolution of mankind, of our evolution and our ability to get beyond more of an animalistic, lower, inferior animal. And that's what they're keeping us from evolving. And I mean, I'm just trying to state the reality, because the superiority is maybe when we're in a lower evolved state, they're superior. But as we evolve, which is what we're trying to do, they're clearly an inferior view. And it's very clear when you look at people dying and the suffering and dying and all these things is not evolved state.
Well, of course. And it's clear when you interpret what he's saying, their real objection, the threat that Wells clearly announced and alerted those on his side was the threat of the middle class, not of the poor. The poor, he had the lowest terminology to describe. They were described as a great excrement, I believe, was something that that needed to be dealt with in a way that those that just couldn't be educated and brought to the level of being able to serve the superior class ought to be exterminated at the earliest possible time. And as I've mentioned to your audience before, he'd said that by the year 2000, the nations that will be ascendant or at the top of the power structure of the world will be those that learn how to exterminate the people of the abyss, as he called them.
How do we know that the elite believe this and follow this? Other than the fact that there's so many bad things going on. But I mean, how do we know that the majority of the elite follow this?
Well, it's not necessary that we know that the majority of them do. The ones at the top are the ones who call the shots. There are few of those. And certainly, without their role in the matter, these things would not be occurring in our country and in our world. We have come so far down the line. The reason I put this story in the end of my book, or near the end of it, chapter 17 instead of the beginning, is that I wanted to lay in place all of the historical facts first in order to support all of those, to provide the proof of what has been done, and then after it's realized that surely, as Henry George said in his 1880 book, toward the end, he made a brief allusion to this, but his book was devoted primarily to what has brought us to such severe poverty right next to wealth, and how to end that situation and end that severe poverty that was being caused. And he went through all of those theories and demolished the theories that had been brought up to cause this poverty in terms of causing it through public policy. He demolished those things and said, here's the way we fix it. And then right at the end, he said, in effect, but I've got to tell you, the way we've come to where we are now, there is a powerful pecuniary force in the world that writes all laws and molds public thoughts. And that, not just in the U.S. He's talking about in the world, certainly in the Western world, so far as Europe, Britain, so forth and so on are concerned, and in the United States. And so he didn't spend the time of his book to prove that case. That's where my book comes in. And the historical facts are there. It's not possible for me to remember all of them or to put them in place in our oral discussions. They're just too many and too much detail. And people can't remember all these things to tell future generations. So in that circumstance, there had to be another book to come along. So,
one of the things that I read from the book is, and this is what you're saying, but I'm gonna reemphasize it. He envisions a reconstructed ethical system, which will govern the elite of the new republic, allowing for the killing of lesser types as a greater service to the whole of mankind. And this is what you're talking about. How do you see it happening now? Some people think the depopulation agenda was abandoned and that they're not as focused on it now as they were. And other people think that it's manifesting itself in the food we eat and maybe World War III and other things.
Many things of that sort are being manifested presently. It certainly hasn't gone away. I can go through a list of various things that would certainly immediately come to mind. Each of them by the mainstream press, which is the propaganda arm for the ruling elite, dispose of them as the CIA term that was coined after the assassination of President Kennedy, who had announced some of the same objectives as Garfield had announced, but more, of course, in our 20th century circumstances. That is conspiracy theory. But the conspiracy theory is an idea not yet supported by evidence. What I presented in my book is hard evidence supported by references to source works that other people can follow up on and research for themselves whether they believe it or not. This is the kind of thing that is so, one of your commenters on one of our earlier discussions said that this had shaken him so hard that it made him sick to actually have to think that the world isn't as we believed it to be when growing up as children. I'd say that in my own experience, it's a very sobering thing to put what I'm telling you next to what we learned as a child, what I learned as a child, that is that every person in America has a good, fair chance. And that you can achieve anything. You can be president. You can be whatever you want in whatever field. Nobody's holding you back. But as I've written recently, for example, I said that the big lie in Franklin Roosevelt's first inaugural speech was his punchline, which was, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. In fact, he knew very well that there was an extremely powerful opposition to all of us, and that they were his sponsor, that he was their guy, that he was their operative. And my book, as I've discussed somewhat with you already, provides that evidence that he knew exactly that and was fully in the service of that clandestine force. So we are now in the situation in confronting these things that we have to ask ourselves, are we willing and able to somehow keep in mind that ideal circumstance of everyone having an equal chance is the ideal, is the rule we ought to live by. We ought to have a country with equal justice under law. We've got to fight for it. We've got to strive for it. We don't have to take that the evil force is always going to be there and always is going to be on top. We have to encounter it, be aware of it, and overcome it.
Well, I would say that the world has changed quite a bit since 1900, and we need a lot of scientists, engineers, people who are trained and educated, which means a strong middle class, to be able to just do the technology and do the new inventions and everything that's just coming and hitting us like a tsunami. Is this something the elites hadn't planned for, that this great wave of innovations and almost like this whole new renaissance was going to hit?
Well, I think the ruling elite as usual, in large part have control of that great new technology, much more than we do. They have access to much more information that has been kept from ordinary people. And so whether they can be unseated with that in their service is a question to be yet to be determined. But at least at this time, at this particular time in our history, it may very well be the best time we've ever had in order to overcome them. Our best opportunity right now. I'm still hopeful that's the case. it certainly is not determined in my mind yet that that we are the winners.
Well, what do you think? What do you think of the billions, the trillions, billions? I'm using the wrong word. It's trillions that are missing from the U.S. government, and it's, you know, being funneled into the black budget. And when you look through decades of government, the last couple decades, you look through the numbers, it shows upwards of 28 trillion. Catherine Austin Fitz has a number. I think she puts it at 40 trillion. What's going on with that money? What are they doing with that?
Well, in one respect, they're keeping it from us. Secondly, I think what they have attempted to do, and are always in the process of it, is using it not to store in a vault in cash terms, far the opposite. They want to turn it into hard assets that amount to real ownership. Currency that they've created is often referred to as a bet currency, but I don't think people necessarily have the correct understanding of what debt currency means. If you look at the money created by the Federal Reserve, which is a private organization that is chartered by the Congress in violation of our Constitution to actually create legal tender to be used as money, it allows that owner of the Federal Reserve to create out of paper what they call currency, and out of paper and ink, they are then able to use that to buy any asset in the world. Ordinarily, it'd be just in our nation, but since we've got imperialism has enabled us to be the sole currency of the world in large part. Not so much anymore, but certainly for many years it's been this way. And that is a debt instrument in the sense that the Fed owes us something of value in the place of that paper. But of course, it's being made worthless by the day. And so they'll wind up in owing nothing because the paper's worth nothing. Now, in the meantime, however, the paper that they've issued from the Federal Reserve has been legal tender in the United States. And so every person working in the U.S. or anyone in the country using dollars is obligated by law to accept that as payment for anything he wishes to sell, whether it's his labor or his products or a book or anything else. And what that paper amounts to is the Federal Reserve promises to pay you the value of a dollar at some point in the future. The value of that dollar is never stated, and as we know by experience, it diminishes, especially since 1971, by the day, so that we provide all of our services and work and toil, and for a period of time, we get to use that money and buy other things like a home or a car and things of that sort and enjoy them. But in the final analysis, the money is worth nothing. In the meantime, while they right now presently, as you were mentioning, Ms. Fitz referring to something like 40 trillion. I believe the number, as I understand it, that she's talking about are the numbers of dollars that have been stolen through the federal government. Mm-hmm. And that is by no means all of the dollars that they have. The Federal Reserve is never audited, and so they can print as many as they want of those dollars and put it into their own pockets, the banks that own the Fed.
Exactly. The fact that it's not audited is absolutely, I don't even know, how can we be in a situation where something like that's not audited? But go ahead.
Yes, and in that circumstance, there are many trillions of dollars in addition to those 40 that, I know this is a lot of money, but I have heard very serious people who've been at this fight for 30, 40 years, who say that there are 300 trillion that have been stolen and by criminal activities and could be clawed back if we get in the position to do so. Now, those are just the ones that these people have said they have documented and traced and can justify the kinds of criminal actions against those people in order to get it back.
How do we claw it back? How can we get that back?
Well,
that's ridiculous. I mean, that's our money. That's the money for the children who are getting crap educations, who aren't getting the stuff they need to be healthy mentally and physically.
Yes, and it's also the tremendous amounts of debt that have been created in order
yes.
to buy what has already been bought.
That's their future. Yes. It's the future of our children and this country, and we could be completely out of debt, and all of our people could have what they need to be, you know, to be prosperous.
Yes, that's what we're talking about. And now, how do we do it? We have a constitutional structure in place. It simply has to be enforced and abided by. I know some people think that this is a constitution that was done by the elite. It's my belief that, as originally written, and that by its own explicit terms, it is a very well designed document to allow us to overcome all of this. The way we get those trillions back is to bring indictments and criminal actions with the evidence available against these people who've done this, and to call them to stand trial and to give up their assets.
So because all of this money has been put into assets, we seize all their assets.
Correct. Some of the assets would be in the form of the precious metals, silver and gold. Many would be in large land masses all over the world. There are all sorts of places that the money has been secreted in ways that they think they can never be recovered. It can happen. It can be. But it needs first to call these people to task and to actually bring them to the dock for punishment.
Well, one of the things that H.G. Wells talks about in the book is a great synthesis, where eventually the American Constitution and the British Crown and Constitution will need to be modified or shelved. And they are discussing now, in a very serious way, modifying the U.S. Constitution. If that happens, we could be out of luck at getting clawing back this money.
I think that's a danger. I'm very cautious about supporting any significant borderless approach toward modifying the Constitution. Unfortunately, what has been happening for largely, certainly ever since the Roosevelt administration and the so-called, the change of heart of most of the Supreme Court under Roosevelt, they've simply been ditching very significant portions of the Constitution. I myself was involved in one Supreme Court decision in which they really completely, not just ignored, but substantially destroyed the protection of the taking clause of the Fifth Amendment that prohibits the taking of private property by the federal government without just compensation. And they wound up not even answering, the most superficial arguments against the federal law that had taken private property and ordered that it be paid to other private parties, not even to the government, with no compensation. It destroyed thousands of Americans and their entire life's work and so forth by taking their assets. And they simply did it because they said, well, they had allowed it to be similar things to be done under the Due Process Clause, which they had also made meaningless by simply saying due process only means not real fairness, but simply a hearing before whatever is done to you is done. And they said, since we've allowed this kind of law to take place under the Due Process Clause, they, by the way, never had a lawyer successful in getting in a taking clause case to present this issue until the case that I had. And at that time, they were obligated to take it under a federal statute as an appeal rather than just a petition, may I please come into the court. And as a result of the case that I had there, taking billions of dollars from the working middle class to be used as the Congress saw fit by other private parties, they simply said, there's nothing that we're going to do to stand in the way of this. The government was actually arguing that money is not property, that requiring cash payments is not a taking of property. And so it was the worst kind of sophistry, and yet that is the way the Constitution is robbed from us by the present approach to government. The same has been true in regard to the taking of life through abortion clinics, as if it's a woman's right to choose, when the woman who is presently on the Supreme Court, who wrote the brief and largely made the argument on Roe versus Wade, just a few years back gave an interview to the Sunday New York magazine, stating that if she had known that what was involved in abortions at the time of Roe versus Wade was really a woman's right to choose what to do with her body, she could have been much more imaginative in making her arguments. What she thought it was back at the time she made the brief was to get rid of all those little babies that we don't want too many of. That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg. So we're pretty far down the line. But at the same time, we have these new tools to be used to get people more aware, to educate people, and we have a chance of getting back to where we need to be. I'd like to add one more point while I have it in mind here. That is comparing my book to that of Henry George. It's really takes a lot of chutzpah, we'll call it, to do that, because within a year or two, he was selling prodigiously all over the world, and he had sold those 2 million copies I've mentioned several times. With all of the tools of modern technology now, I was able to get my book out. I actually think that Henry George would regard it as the next book, a worthy successor to what he wrote, to take up that powerful pecuniary force and to bring it to task. And And it is that a book of that significance, far more so than I thought when I began writing it.
Well, there's nothing like it out there. That's very clear.
But in comparison to that 2 million, I had an original publishing of 2,500. And in the first 6 years of its existence, I've sold less than 1,000, probably substantially less. Even with all of the ability, I say this because I look at it and I'm astounded at what somehow got into it by one means or another. The whole Henry George thing, I told you how that happened. There's another aspect that got into it simply because a lady I'd met back in Tennessee who had me on her radio show before my book came out, or maybe about the time it did, something of the sort, sent me a, well, it's the one that told me about the H.G. Wells book. it gave me the tip on that one because it had appeared in a magazine called the Manhattan Institute, which appeared to be a fair discussion of it, and calling my attention to it when I hadn't been aware of it previously. And so things like that have a way of coming about. But as I say, I'm astonished that I think Henry George would think it's a worthwhile book.
Well, I think it's a worthwhile book in the sense that you're going to learn from that book things that you've just, it's going to change your paradigm of what you thought. And everything is well researched. It's the truth. There's beauty in truth. And truth is the only thing that can help us be free and to help us have a prosperous and evolve as a human species. I want you to come back to talk about the Red Symphony, because that's another really important piece that we haven't been able to talk about. We only have a minute here that we need to close up. But so I'm going to give you the floor for the next minute, and then we got to close.
Well, thank you. I've certainly taken lots of time today, and I appreciate your audience. They've been very generous in their comments, and certainly I appreciate you. I'd like to say that this book is built for generations. It's well put together, and it's, I think, worthy. But I think it's hard to discuss these things at times. But over a period of years, it's necessary that they be recalled to people's attention in order for them to have perspective on where they are. You talked about all of the things that are happening today, the spraying of the skies that are described by NASA in 2001 as the kind of it is a mechanical analog, they call it, to biological weapons of mass destruction. That is, they're sprayed very, very micronic size, a billion to 1 inch, particles of heavy metals. They are highly destructive to every living thing. They're being sprayed in our skies every day and around the world. So vaccinations are being used to spread disease and not to cure them. The vaccinations back in the 60s for polio were contaminated with cancer viruses. And so those kinds of things are what we're still facing. And thank you again for having me.
Thank you so great. Much. We are going to have you back to do the Red Symphony, and there's a lot more to dig into there. And I appreciate you so much and for all the work that you're doing.
Thank you very much, Sarah, and thanks to your audience.